supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Some say Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg's recent book, Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead, is a sort of nouveau feminist manifesto. The book broadly spells out how American women are doing in the workplace. There are depressing statistics about wages and opportunities, but there are also constructive insights into how Sandberg landed her dream job at Facebook. She was here in Philadelphia recently, and she had this to say about why she wrote the book.
So I wrote Lean In because, you know, the blunt truth is men still run the world. And, you know, I'm not sure that's going that well. And so Lean In is about getting to equality. And there are messages in the book for women, for men, and institutions. For women, I'll give one for each. For women, the message is about believing in ourselves and believing that we can lead and nurture, believing that we can be great professionals and great mothers if we choose to. It's a choice everyone needs to make. For men, the book is about understanding that equality benefits you. If you are a more engaged partner and father, you have a happier home, more sex with your wife, very motivating for many people. Your kids are happier. And if you're a better manager of women, you're going to outperform your colleagues. So leaning in for men is, don't do it as a favor, leaning in is for you. And for institutions, it's that if we can change our own minds, we can then reform our institutions to make them supportive of women in leadership.
That was Sheryl Sandberg here in Philadelphia to promote her book, Lean In. It's about women and leadership, and that's the subject of our show today on Voices. We'll hear from a number of women today who are leaning in one way or the other. In just a little while, we'll speak with the founder of a new school for entrepreneurship. We'll speak with a psychologist who coaches women to follow their passions and their strengths, and an executive who mentors other women to take the reins. But first, let's meet Bonnie St. John. She's the co-author of How Great Women Lead, a mother-daughter adventure into the lives of women shaping the world, which she wrote with her daughter, Darcy Dean. She's worked in the White House during the Clinton administration as a director of the National Economic Council. She's currently CEO of the Courageous Spirit Incorporated. She's also the first African-American to win a medal in the Paralympic Games as a ski racer. Bonnie St. John, welcome to Voices.
Thank you. Great topic today. I'm excited.
Yeah, Bonnie, I am so sorry that you haven't had a more interesting life. My heart breaks for you. Listen, you and your teenage daughter got to interview some pretty impressive people in your book. I'm going to read a few. Hillary Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, Sheryl Sandberg, UN Ambassador Susan Rice, actress Gina Davis, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. What did you ask these women, and what did you learn?
We asked all kinds of questions about what leadership meant to them, how did they define it, how did they see future leaders being different from leaders today, the things they struggled with, both professionally and personally. It was tough, actually, to write the book and to be able to narrow it down. I could have written double the size of the book with all the wonderful stories and insights that we got.
So, do you have any themes that you heard?
So many, on so many different levels. One of the things I think is interesting that I think is different from had we interviewed a series of male leaders, one of the themes that came up was delegating, letting go of some of the detail. And I think women tend to be more perfectionist, and the research shows our brains remember more detail. So that was something you saw come up again and again, whether it was Sharon Allen, the chairman of Deloitte, or Condoleezza Rice. A number of women talked about struggling to learn to really delegate and empower other people around them and overcome our perfectionist tendencies as women.
Hmm. Do you think that those perfectionist tendencies, and we'll talk about this later with psychologist Beth Weinstock, do you think those tendencies are something that is about a woman's wiring or brain structure, or is it something that the external environment has imposed on women as they achieve more?
I think it's a bit of both. I really do think some of it is our wiring and the way we remember things. And I don't want to make it all sound like a curse. I think it is a strength and a weakness. In the final chapter, Darcy goes back to New Zealand by herself, my daughter, and interviews her father's mother, who was the first woman to be chairman of a multi-million-dollar dairy manufacturing company. And she talks in that chapter, her grandmother talks specifically about how her attention to detail was what allowed her to turn this company around, to create international partnerships, and that she felt she had a lot more attention to detail than the men, and that was a strength.
Hmm. In your book, Bonnie, you said that leadership has evolved from being command-driven to inspiration-driven. Certainly, you know, leadership should be that way, but has it really evolved that far? Did you get a sense that it has?
Oh, absolutely. And that's true for men and women. I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is, even at West Point, they say, we stopped teaching command and control leadership in the 80s. Because they looked around at the world, and it's a volatile world with lots of change and lots of uncertainty, and they needed to push decision-making down to a lower level. They could not run the military in the way the world has changed in a command-and-control way. And so it's not even the military is doing it. And I think as we get into more and more knowledge work and more complex ideas and requiring more teamwork and collaboration and agile responses to the environment, we absolutely need more people's discretionary effort. And so an inspirational leader, as opposed to somebody who's just holding you accountable for your actions, it's an inspirational leader who's really going to get your best, most creative effort, who's going to get the intangibles out of their people, the more creative, best performance.
That.
So I think as work changes, it's hard for us to keep leading in the same way.
That's an interesting skill set, being an inspirational leader. That's not something we learn in school, is it, or is it? Can we learn inspire?
It's interesting because I've had leaders that I work with. I work with leaders in a variety of settings, and sometimes women-only groups, sometimes co-ed groups. But I've had leaders come to me and say, look, you do a lot of inspirational speaking all around the country. Help me to learn some of what you know about how to be inspirational. And so I've done that for individuals and for groups as well. And I do think it's becoming a much more important skill. And it's always been an important skill, say, at the CEO level. But that need is being pushed down lower and lower into the organization.
I was interested, Bonnie, when you interviewed Maren Alsop. She's the conductor of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. She said that being a conductor was easier for man. She said when he walks onto the podium, they're not seeing a man. They're waiting. They see a conductor, and they're waiting for music. Not so for one. They have to get past seeing a woman before they see a conductor. Would you say that's true for most women leaders?
I think it is frequently a problem in a lot of industries. The music industry, the classical music industry, is so male-dominated. It's a very extreme problem there. But in many other situations, it is. Here's an interesting window into that. A woman on Wall Street at a very high level, who's African-American, said to me, early in my career, it was harder to be black. But as I rose up to the top, it was harder to be a woman.
Why is that?
And I think, again, it comes back to your original question about do they see a man or do they see a leader or do they see a woman, is it's earlier on in her career, being black was more of an issue, it was more of a difference, but as you rise up, the expectations of leaders are stereotypically based on male roles. So are you tall? Do you have a deep voice? Do you have a commanding presence? And a commanding presence is generally associated with a male presence. So our ideas of what constitutes good leadership that we're comfortable with stem from a lot of male stereotypes. So a woman has to carve a new path and carve to help you find new subliminal comfort with the image of what a woman leader looks like, which doesn't necessarily look like what a man looks like. You know, or you know, all the intangibles, the way it feels.
Subliminal comfort. Say more.
Pardon?
What's that mean? Where a woman has to create subliminal comfort in other.
Again, going back to the Marin Alsop example, which I think is great, she's the only woman conducting an orchestra in a major U.S. city. So that's amazing. She's singular. When she stands in the podium, she said she can't wave her baton the same way a man can. And we thought, why not? A man waves his baton, you wave your baton. It looks the same. And so she explained to us, this is hard to do with audio only, but if she waves her baton with her pinky in the air, like the way you hold a fine teacup, if she waves her baton that way, if a man does that, it means delicate music. If she does it, she looks like a girly conductor. So the way we see things literally looks different. The shape of a woman's body, the way she moves her arms, you know, a conductor conducts with their whole body, and people are just comfortable with the way a man's body moves to conduct. So I've heard musicians say, we don't like women conductors, male and female, because they're just not used to it. And I think that's a metaphor for what happens in the business world as well. And we know women can't go into a meeting and act the same way a man does. They bang her fist on the table or curse at the men. Some women do that, but it's not always received in the same way that it would be from a man. And the women in the book talked about that, Sharon Allen in particular and Amy Pascal, about having to find their own style and be comfortable with their own style, even if it's different than what other people are used to. That women often have a choice of, do I act like what I think I'm expected to act like as a leader, or do I act like what is the most comfortable leadership style for me? And you have to navigate.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Bonnie St. John. We're talking about women and leadership today. She's the co-author of How Great Women Lead, A Mother-Daughter Adventure into the Lives of Women Shaping the World. Really interesting book. Do you feel, Bonnie, that I'm struggling with language here. Do you feel that it is a woman's leader's job, in part, to educate?
Interesting. A number of answers pop into my head when you say that, and I would say, isn't it every leader's job to educate? That one definition I heard, I was just at a conference, so I can't quote anyone on this, but it was somebody said, and I loved it, great leaders help people to see what they haven't seen before, help people to envision what isn't real yet. So there are leaders that are just keeping the status quo going, and those leaders can be very important to manage a going concern. But then there are also leaders who help transform, and they're always educating. They're always helping people see new paths. That's what was really exciting. Again, we'll go back to the orchestra conductor is, not only did she break the paradigm of how people thought of conductors, because it was a very narrow male stereotype, and frankly, very arrogant, you don't talk to the audience, you acted a certain way, and she expanded that in so many ways, but not only did she break the archetype that paved the way for more women, she broke the archetype in a way that paved the way for more different kinds of men, just more different kinds of leaders. And so that's very exciting in terms of what does it take to solve today's complex problems? We need to see new paths and new styles of leadership coming from men and women.
You wrote this book with your daughter. I love to hear what it was like. I mean, beyond what you two learned intellectually, what was the experience like for both of you?
Well, we started when she was 14, was when I first asked her, and the project got rolling as she was 15 and 16, and anybody who's had a daughter at that age knows there's a certain amount of drama, so we had a certain amount of drama along the road, which was fun and exciting, as well as it could be frustrating at times, but it was great because it kept us together. I think that's an age when mothers and daughters can really fight a lot, and it gave us this common project that was exciting and pulled her out of her peer groups too in schools just to see a wider world. And I think it was very, very good for us.
How old is she?
She's 18 now, so she's a senior in high school.
I wonder what it was like for her when she interviewed her grandmother.
That was so wonderful because she had done all the other interviews, and we would, for each person, we would research on the internet or read books that they had written, and then we would put our heads together and come up with the questions we were going to ask, and we would fight over that, you know, and then we would all, you know, get into the moment, and we're asking the questions and learning. And so, although she's known her grandmother all her life, to go back and she researched her grandmother. She looked at all the articles that were written about her grandmother as a business leader. She interviewed other people who knew her to get that background and then formulated her questions and interviewed her grandmother like she would any other leader. And that gave her, you know, I'm so glad she had the chance to do that while her grandmother's still alive because it's she got an experience and a connection that she wouldn't have been able to appreciate any other way. She also said it's made her appreciate her father and other people. She just appreciates leadership so much more now.
Bonnie, how do you counsel women who come to you and say they're dealing with adversity and sexism? How do you counsel them?
Well, that's a big, broad question, but I can give you some broad categories. And it's interesting, you talk about sexism. Of course, I'm African-American, so there's also racism, and I have a disability, and so there are people dealing with discrimination because they're disabled in the workforce. And I think there are times when you need to not let it distract you from your performance, and you need to just put it aside and focus on your performance and move ahead. There are times when you need to make sure you have enough of a network that you can neutralize whatever is going on with the other person. There's subtleties of how you handle different things depending on what's going on. And so it's very important to have good mentors that understand the context that you're in and maybe some mentors that are outside the context that you're in. It's important to have networks that can keep you strong so that one person can't bring you down, which I've seen people try to do. So it really depends on the context. There isn't just one way to respond.
You know, you talked about mentors and how critical they are, and of course they are. But, you know, I'm thinking this generation of women have more mentors than previous. I think of the earlier generations of women that were kind of on their own.
Well, you're assuming women mentors. What you mean is they have more women mentors that they have access to.
Yeah.
But, of course, women can have male mentors, and a lot of the successful women definitely have very strong male mentors and sponsors and supporters. So it's important. Condoleezza Rice, in the book, How Great Women Lead, specifically talks about not confining your mentors to people who look like you. So if you're black, you don't have to have all black mentors. If you're a woman, you don't need all women mentors, you know. And you really want the best mentors, and I think you want diversity.
Do you consider yourself a strong woman?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, I was hoping you would say that.
I think I can be pretty strong. I wanted to say one thing to you about writing the book with my daughter.
Yeah.
Is that, of course, I knew it would be really good for my daughter and great to bring her along. And, you know, it's partly work-life balance for me because instead of having a book take me away from my daughter, it brought us together. But it was also something I really wanted to do for the readers of the book because, you know, Sheryl Sandberg's book about Lean In, encouraging women to really embrace leadership, put your foot on the gas pedal and go. And there's so many women. I've been in corporate America working with leaders of all types for over 20 years now, and I've seen a lot of women be ambivalent about stepping into leadership. And so writing another book that analyzed women's leadership and had really theoretical frameworks for leadership, I knew wasn't going to attract those women who were sort of on the fence. So I wanted to write a book that was passionate and exciting and personal and fun to read. the former CEO of Campbell Soup said, I've never read a book on leadership where you keep turning the page to find out what happens next. You know, so I wanted to write a book that would draw people in, that would help women lean in.
Well,
and I think we really did that.
As we get to the end of our time together here, Bonnie, I just want to tell you, mission accomplished with that book on all counts. It was wonderful and important, and I thank you so much for writing it.
And thank you. Well, thank you for keeping this conversation going. I think that's something Sheryl Sandberg really did, is to raise the visibility of this conversation.
Well, thank you, and best of luck. Take care.
Thank you.
We've been listening to Bonnie St. John. She's the co-author of How Great Women Lead. She wrote it along with her daughter, Darcy Dean. Like I said earlier, she worked at the White House during the Clinton administration and is currently CEO of the Courageous Spirit Incorporated. She's also the first African-American to win a medal in the Paralympic Games as a ski racer. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to speak with Donna DeCarolis and Beth Weinstock. We're going to take this apart and look at it much further. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Richard A. Reif Heart Institute of Doylestown Hospital supports WHYY. When a heart attack strikes, cardiac specialists know it's survival of the fastest. At Doylestown, they've worked to streamline every step of the treatment process, striving for faster care, fewer complications, and the best possible outcomes. Located on West State Street in Doylestown, the Heart Institute is now easily accessible via the Route 202 expansion. Details at dh.org/heart.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. University of the Sciences accepts transfer students into its undergraduate degree programs and offers convenient evening office hours to help students with their questions and learn about the admission process. Students can also find out about starting or furthering their career in pharmacy, chemistry, healthcare business, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and more. More online at usciences.edu/transfer.
I think fear is at the heart of what holds women back. I write this in my book, you know, the fear of not being liked, very big for women. The fear of doing something badly, of being embarrassed, of finding out you really are the fraud you think you are. The holy trinity of fear, being a bad wife, mother, daughter.
Another nod to Sheryl Sandberg talking about her book, Lean In. Well, we're joined now, furthering our discussion of women and leadership, with Donna DeCarolis and Beth Weinstock. Donna is the founding dean of the Charles D. Close School of Entrepreneurship at Drexel University. Donna, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Beth Weinstock is a leadership coach and clinical psychologist. She's part of the Resilience Group in Narberth. Beth, welcome.
Thank you, Dan.
So I want to start with you, Donna. When I see the title founding dean, I imagine this is not something that was handed you by a benevolent philanthropist. So tell us about the new school and how it happened. I would imagine there was some heavy lifting on your part.
Yes, absolutely. So that's a two-part question. So let me talk about why the school was founded. And it just fits so well into this conversation about empowerment and dreaming and envisioning what is not yet real, because the Close School of Entrepreneurship at Drexel approaches entrepreneurship as more than starting a new venture. We really believe it is a habit of mind and an attitude of pursuing innovation in life, in your career, and in whatever you do. And that is really the broad foundation of what the school is. And I'll tell you why we believe this. It's because there's a market need in higher education to produce graduates who are ready for a 21st century workplace that is very different than a workplace of the 20th century. We know, for example, that students, when they graduate, will have at least 10 jobs by the time they're 45 in multiple industries, multiple positions. Many of those jobs will be self-employment or starting a new venture. So what are we doing to prepare them to manage their careers in an entrepreneurial way? So a very broad definition of entrepreneurship. And I thought about this when I was writing a proposal for the school, is what are we doing for our students to prepare them for this new world? How do we give them a path to entrepreneurship, the skills that they need that is broadly defined?
Hmm. So tell us about you. Did you have to push this? You may have mentioned, or someone did, I'm pretty sure it was you that mentioned about glass ceilings in academia.
So what I saw at the university, and what I know I see at other universities, is sort of a mismatch between what's happening with millennials and the types of education that we're delivering to them. But millennials are dreamers. They're very good with technology. They're very exposed to technology, and they're very, very interested in this thing called entrepreneurship. So, in thinking about how we help this generation to become a generation of entrepreneurs broadly defined, that's really how this school got started. So there was a lot of forethought that went into this proposal, if you will. And I was fortunate enough, I drafted this proposal because a school of entrepreneurship is very unusual. It sits outside of the business school. It's collaborative with the other schools and colleges at the university. And it's a disruptive innovation in higher education. And so when I brought this proposal to my leader, to our president, he was pleased to see it, and we were given the donation to start the school.
Hmm. I always saw entrepreneurship historically mm-hmm. as a male bastion, mm-hmm. and here you are a dean of an entrepreneurial ship, and I wondered when I was reading about Maren Alsop, the conductor. I wonder what your experience is of leading an entrepreneurship school.
So I'm glad you asked me that. When I was asked to be the founding dean, I can honestly say that I was asked to be the founding dean because they believed that I can do the job and not because I was a woman. I think the fact that I was a woman is an added benefit as a role model for students and for entrepreneurs. But the impetus was really that largely the school was of my creation. I mean, I sort of dreamed about this school and pushed for this school and was lucky enough to have the leadership to actually make this happen. Hmm. So although I am a woman, I think the choice was really made on ability.
Hmm. Isn't that wonderful? So, Beth, I want to bring you in to the discussion. Been watching you since we went on the air, and you've been nodding your head and taking notes. One of the things you said that was interesting to me was that women were raised to believe that ambition is a four-letter word.
I think that's true, and I think that that's in part what Bonnie was referring to about ambivalence when she mentioned it earlier in the show. I think that women, we've been raised to not be so visible and to feel uncomfortable if in fact we stand out. And ambition is a word that has been associated positively with men and negatively with women. Even amongst women, there's the thought of, oh, she's so ambitious, as if that's something that's not positive. When, of course, ambition is wonderful. It's about vision, commitment, discipline, wanting to see something through and feeling good about it. And I think it's important for women to begin to embrace that it's okay to have ambition and to work towards it.
Were you raised, Beth, that way?
I think I was one of the lucky people. I was raised in a family where I was told really I could do anything. And my mother was a good model in that she worked all of my childhood life. So I didn't particularly have that. But in the women that I coach, I find that multiple times, and certainly in my psychology practice, I find that there's a fear about stepping out and making oneself known. And I think that relates then to women being assertive in their leadership, because if we speak up, if we say something that may not be popular, it can be a very frightening moment. And I think that's one of the things that Sandberg was talking about in terms of fear.
I am curious, Nana, about your background, if you don't mind. What did you learn directly, indirectly, in your family about women and ambition and leadership? What were the messages you got?
So there were no messages. I was raised very traditional Italian Catholic, and so my role models were the stay-at-home mom, the women that cooked and took care of the children. My father was much more encouraging of me going out and pursuing education, getting my PhD, doing entrepreneurial things, working at the university. So that was my background. I don't know what it is that made me decide that I was who I was and wanted to be ambitious.
You wanted to become who you were.
Yes.
And you don't know what it was that got into you? Or was it always there?
Perhaps it was always there. Perhaps it was always there.
Beth Weinstock, it is always there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And then there are layers of things we've got to clear away in order to find out who we really are, what kind of leaders we are. You know, what's our gift and talent as a leader? And then, again, the courage to step forward, lean in, and be that person. Mm.
Donna, I would imagine over the years you have mentored many men and women. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference?
I would actually have to echo what Beth said and what Bonnie has said, in that women tend to be a little more reluctant in their aspirations and in their leadership. But I must say that I do find that's changing, especially with this newer generation of students. I feel as though, because of technology, because of globalization, because of competition, because of the things that we're teaching them, that the playing field is a little more even. And so I feel as though this generation of women will not be feeling the types of inhibitors that we felt.
I'd like to speak to that. Yeah, you know, I think that that's true. And I think part of what's needed now is a lot of conversation about how do we lean in? What does leaning in look like? And how do we move into the ambition that we really have?
Wait a minute. I'm the host. I do the questions. You do the answers. So answer those questions.
Okay, I will. Because, we're talking about many of the barriers that women have, and I'm very grateful to Sandberg. I think she did a beautiful job in getting honest about her own experience as well as other women's. And I think that now what we need to do is talk about, how do I help so-and-so lean in? How do we manage the interior fear that says, if I speak up, I'll make a fool of myself? How do I coach myself to do that?
How?
Well, one way is to get really aware of the negative self-talk that many of us have. What's going on in our heads that says, maybe I shouldn't say what I'm about to say? So we have to raise our awareness. And then we have to begin to talk back to the negative self-speak. We have to get really talented. We got to get skillful at how we speak back.
Do you see that as a gender issue? Because whenever I give a lecture, I ask everybody in the audience, raise your head if you don't have a voice inside your head that criticizes you. I've yet to see a hand.
You have yet to see a hand go up that acknowledges that?
No. Everybody in the audience, every audience.
I think men and women both have that voice. In my experience, women have it louder, more persistently, and in the workplace, it's the voice that gets in the way. I think that men and women have it in different domains differently.
We're talking about shame, it sounds like. Donna, you wanted to say something earlier?
Just to jump in about, the inner voices and what we can do to resolve that or to begin to resolve that. And, you know, I think we have a huge opportunity with women in particular. And it does start in high. We can have the conversation in higher education. In the Drexel School of Entrepreneurship, we can teach them about not being afraid to fail. We can have them experience starting something in a safe environment. We can teach them about entrepreneurial alertness. But in my view, and I have a teenage daughter, and I also have two sons, the conversation has to start earlier. I think it's appalling the amount of bullying, for example, among, you know, middle and high school girls. This is where the idea of alliances, collaborations, supporting each other, that's where the conversation needs to begin, so that they're not growing up into the workplace and feeling as though they need to sabotage, unfortunately, other female. I would just like to see a conversation starting earlier about women's leadership and the need to support each other.
That was Donna DeCarolis. She's founding dean of the Charles D. Close School of Entrepreneurship at Drexel. We're also joined here by Beth Weinstock. She's a psychologist and leadership coach in Narberth. Beth, you talk in a Huffington Post article. You focus specifically on Sheryl Sandberg's observation that barriers to women's success don't just come from the outside, but women have stopped themselves. That brings us to a potentially complex neighborhood here, because we don't want to be blaming women
Absolutely.
For their problems. We've been doing that for the last 3,000 or 4,000 years.
Absolutely. And I institutionally, there's a lot that needs to change. For any individual, I think it's important for her to look at what individually gets in my own way that I can work on in order to get past my own barriers. Far from blaming women, I think that Sheryl Sandberg opened a very wide, wide area of talking about what motivates women, what holds them back, what different ways women are held. You mentioned shame before, Dan, and I think in part we're beginning to talk about shame that women carry around how they're not doing X, Y, and Z enough. And it can be in the home domain or in the work domain. This is not about blaming women in any way, and I think you're right. It could be a dicey subject, but I think that the issue is how any one of us takes responsibility both for our own change as well as giving back what we can to help that change. And I love what Donna said about starting that earlier, because that sense of I can and we can does need to start earlier.
You know, when I first, well, it was about 10 years after I became a quadriplegic, and someone said to me, Dan, you're a teacher now, whether you want to or not, that what you do, you're a teacher. People are going to learn about you no matter what you do, positive, negative, how you carry yourself and how you don't. And I know you didn't ask for this, but this is the truth. You teach. And, you know, I feel it's my responsibility now to teach that one can be both disabled and happy and strong, for lack of a better word. And women in leadership are the same way. I mean, they need to teach. They're teachers. And women who have these internal voices that hold them back, you know, they're role models. They're role models one way or the other.
Oh, absolutely. And I think almost everyone in those positions has those voices that they need to work on. One of the things I loved about Sandberg's honesty was the voice inside her head that she needs to deal with.
We've got to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to include Autumn Bayliss into this discussion. It's going to be very interesting. She's president of Mentoring Network for Women Leaders. Well, we're talking about women and leadership today on Voices in the Family. So far, we've been listening to Donna DeCarolis and Beth Weinstock. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, aged 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has strengthened children and families. The Foundation supports nonprofit organizations that enhance parenting, mentor youth, create safe environments, advance individual education, and advocate for children and families. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or fellafound.org.
I think the most important thing we need to do as women is let ourselves off the hook to not do everything perfectly. Leaning in does not mean you do everything everyone asked of you and stay up all night working. The opposite. Lean in is about figuring out what's important to us and doing those things and letting ourselves off the hook.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about women and leadership with Donna DeCarolis and Beth Weinstock. I'm also joined here by Autumn Bayliss. She is head of the Forum of Executive Women. She's vice president of global operations, operational excellence at Aramark. Autumn, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dan.
So what's your job? What's involved with being a vice president of global operations excellence?
So what that means is how we efficiently deliver services to our clients. So in terms of, you know, doing things the same way consistently all the time in the most efficient manner and with the greatest levels of client satisfaction.
It's a big job.
Well, it's fun. It definitely keeps me busy and out of trouble.
Tell me about the Executive Women's Forum. Who's in it and what's its function? I've been hearing about it for a while now from our own Kira McGrath, who's COO here at WHYY.
Right, and Kira is actually a past president of the Forum. So the Forum of Executive Women is a group of 400 or so executive women in this region, and we are part of this group that has many facets to it. I mean, obviously, there's a network involved there of peers where you can talk to each other and rely on each other, but we actually try to accomplish some real work at the same time. So we do have a mentoring program that you mentioned before, and we mentor what we call emerging women, so women who haven't yet reached the executive level but, you know, are well on their way, and see if there are things that we can do to help them stay on that path and get there.
What's your experience? What do they need to help them stay on the path, and what are the risks? What are the...
So that's an excellent question. There's a couple of things. I mean, one thing is the path that a woman has to follow to get to the executive ranks, you know, has some twists and turns to it. It's not necessarily as much of a given as it could be in other situations. So oftentimes, you know, these women need a role model. There's not as many executive women as there are men, so they need somebody that they can look up to and say, well, I can aspire to that. So there's the role model piece. There's, you know, a helping hand as they encounter obstacles that are, of course, going to come up. How do they balance things, which tends to be a little more tricky. And we just tried to provide them with that framework of support, advice, yes, you know, sort of cheerleading, yes, you can get there, and some practical hints and tips on how to, you know, make the path a good one.
All right. You talked about balancing things, and you said which can be a little more tricky, and when I hear the word tricky as a clinician, boy, that's just like a welcome mat, you know?
Right.
tell me more. And actually, I want to hear from all three of my guests about that issue. That's background noise all the time about balancing things. So, Autumn, let's start with you.
Sure. I think that you know, this certainly doesn't apply just to women. I mean, I certainly have men that work for me that have issues as well, but it seems to be more prevalent in women who tend to take on more family responsibilities. And, you know, these women want, they're aspirational, they have ambition, they want to do well in their careers, and at the same time, they have other obligations that are important to them and of value to them, and they're trying to figure out how to make it all work. And some companies tend to provide a framework that is more easily able to accommodate that, and some do not. So part of our work is we do try to work with companies and the women themselves to figure out how can we thoughtfully make this workable and a win-win for both parties. But when I say tricky, I think it's just not a, you know, every woman is different, every company is different, and it's not a slam dunk.
It is far from a slam dunk. Donna DeCarlis, I want to turn to you both professionally and personally. You said you got children.
Yes.
Three.
Three children. Three children, had my two boys while I was getting my PhD, and my first year at Drexel had my third. So this whole issue of balance, I honestly don't believe there's such a thing. And I think one of the great things that Sandberg brought out in her book was it, you know, it's very rational. If you're not doing one thing, you're doing something else, there's a trade-off. I'm not sure that, personally for myself, I've ever reached a state of this balance. I think it's more in how we position this, and it's what needs to be done at the time for your responsibilities and for yourself and where your happiness is. I really don't believe that there's a this thing called, what does balance mean? Is it a certain percentage of my day is is job and a certain percentage is children? Life is messy. It doesn't work that way.
I want to say that I have achieved balance in my life, and it lasts for 15, 20 minutes.
Right.
So what do you mean what's happening at the moment? I mean, how do you deal with those issues?
Right. So, you know, one of the things I've learned, and if there's one thing that I wish I could teach my children and students, is this idea of being present. You know, whatever it is at the moment that requires your attention, your passion, your interest, your energy, that's what you should be doing. And I think that's a difficult lesson to learn. I think particularly for women, when we're, as Beth said, we're laden with the nurturing responsibilities and the guilt, and the we have to do it all. And I applauded Sandberg for saying that, you know, having it all is not the way this should be positioned.
So, Beth Weinstock, let me turn to you. So, would you agree with Donna that, as they say in Brooklyn, balance, forget about it?
Yeah, I think balance, forget about it. I think it's a lot about giving ourselves permission to be making different choices at different times in our lives. Mm-hmm. And then to be really self-compassionate about the things that we're not getting to, that we feel deeply about, that we wish we could, and we sometimes have to let go of.
So what's the difference between giving ourselves permission to follow our passion and self-indulgence and selfishness?
Boy, that's a big one, Dan. I think often women err on the side of not being what we might call selfish enough. And if one's not going to take care of oneself, who is? I think men are pulled in many directions also. It's not just a women's issue. We do know, however, that women wind up doing the bulk of the housework, the bulk of the groceries, and that women are pulled all the time. It's a very hard job to have a work job, whether it's a serious career, just a job and children and a home. And if you're in the sandwich generation, you're taking care of elder parents as well. It's all okay. Whatever we can manage, I think we need to give ourselves permission to do what we can and then take time for ourselves when we can. Other people might call it selfish, but I think, if anything, women err on the side of not attending to themselves enough.
Donna DeCarolis?
And actually, if I could add to that, I think something that a lot of us do not do is to actually seek other female support. I know personally that when I hear my friends say, oh, I'm feeling the same thing, when you feel that others are feeling the same thing, it lessens your burden.
I think that's true. And I think traditionally, working women have sometimes been made to feel guilty about not being at home, and women at home have felt badly about not being career women. And if, in fact, we can keep talking about it and mm-hmm. sharing, that goes away.
I want to hear you, Autumn Bayless, weigh in on this. Is this your experience with women that you mentors that struggle, and how do you help them through it?
Absolutely. I actually think it's the number one thing that women in that emerging phase, because they tend to be, you know, at the height of having small children and some other demands, it's the number one thing and the number one question we get asked is, how do I do this? How can I navigate this path when, you know, I'm ambitious, I want to accomplish this in my career, but at the same time, you know, my family's very important to me.
One of the things I think I hear coming from Beth and Donna is not to necessarily march in lockstep to what's happening in your heart, but at least to listen to your heart, to sit down and listen to the quiet voice inside your heart. And then it seems to me that you're going to be more empowered and you can make better choices for yourself instead of listening to those voices inside your head that say, push this or go there, or you shouldn't do that, or those voices inside our heads. And, you know, frankly, I just see them as scared children. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I really want to thank all three of you so much for joining us. It's such an enlightening and important show. We've been talking about women and leadership with Donna DeCarolis and Beth Weinstock and Autumn Bayless. Earlier in the show, we heard from Bonnie St. John. Again, thanks all of you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about strengthening marriages, divorce prevention. Please comment on today's show. We'd love to hear from you. We're at whyy.org/voices. That's, you can listen to the show on that website or download it there or on iTunes. Follow us. We're at Voices in the Fam on Twitter, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been John Knapp. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has been providing services to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Founded locally by pioneering schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization now helps individuals across our nation to live healthier, happier, and